Hey, y'all. Gus again. Welcome to episode 6. This week, we'll be covering three chapters. Chapter 19, What Freedom Looks Like. Chapter 20, The King's Justice. And chapter 21, Means of Escape. And just a reminder, we have our new Gmail address up. So if you have any comments or corrections or whatever you want to say to us, go ahead and give us a little dingle at laudcast@gmail.com. That is laudcast@gmail.com. All right, guys, I'll see you again at the end of the episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first Laudcast. My name is Gus Storms.
I was laughing. I'm sorry. Do it again. I'm sorry. I'm actually sorry.
Okay.
I was just laughing.
Gus. And do it right.
Okay, guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first Laudcast. My name is Gus Storms, and these are my co-hosts, Ian Bertram.
Hi, Gus.
And Peter Schmidt.
It's a Friday this time, guys. It's totally shocking.
Okay. In this podcast, we will be examining the ins and outs of Joe Abercrombie's first law trilogy, including peripheral novels and short stories, moving chapter by chapter through the works of our grimdark master. I'll also know we'll be giving proper recognition to the audiobook versions of these works, primarily read by the great, amazing, perfect Stephen Pacey. So if you guys are reading along, I recommend getting the audiobook as well. As we said last episode, and we should all look into this maybe, I don't know what the royalties are for audiobook readers, but I hope Pacey's getting a big fat check from all of our purchases.
I'm sure there's a Patreon that you can support. And we would suggest that you...
Or like a cameo. Maybe Pacey, oh my God. Would Pacey do a cameo? I mean, he probably doesn't exist on it, but like, holy shit, if I could get him to read like a birthday message from Glockta to me.
Yeah, if we can't get him, we could get like Logan Paul to do it or something. That'd be pretty tight too.
Well, no, like a tete-a-tete between, yeah, like them and the Suicide Forest. Is that right? That's an old reference. Is that Logan Paul?
Yes. No, that is Logan Paul. That was
Glockta torturing Logan Paul.
Oh.
Logan Paul is a bit of a Giselle in a, like a good way. And I mean,
that's what I said.
Literally said that last episode, Ian. I totally disagree. I think that's
I see it more and more.
Wait, you said that last episode? I don't remember that at all.
I did. It just seeped into your subconscious, Peter.
Is this another one of those things where like you said it and I don't shit? That happened last episode too, where I said a thing and you were like, you said that last time. I didn't remember. This is a nightmare.
Okay, let's not hammer that nail in too far.
Hammered in far enough. We're cool. The point is we want to get across to our audience that we're cool. We're cool guys who...
Oh, yeah. So for anybody who's joining us, it's sort of a watch-along style podcast, but as I call it, a read-along. We are right now covering Joe Abercrombie's first book in the First Law trilogy called The Blade Itself. This week, chapters 19, 20, and 21.
That's What Freedom Looks Like, The King's Justice, and Means of Escape.
Means of Escape. Mm-hmm. So this, we last week finished up part one of the book, and it introduced us to a bunch of our main characters, and we get one more interesting character starting at the very intro of part two.
Yes.
Ian, is that our last POV character for this trilogy?
I think it is. Yes.
So we have the full cast going on here, which is pretty fun.
Like, I get that this character, Pharaoh, they have kind of like a Logan vibe to them. They're another fighter type. If only Logan's intro was this strong. This is a very strong intro for a character. You know, it didn't take four chapters of kind of like meandering around and hanging out with Kwai to get there. You know?
I dare to say that is part of the distinction between their characters. Logan is fundamentally ambivalent about his role in the world until in certain instances he is not. Whereas Pharaoh is completely dedicated to the hill. I mean, just...
Oh, it's her entire identity.
Irrepressibly dedicated.
I don't know the dedication other than to staying alive right now, which is Logan's whole thing.
Vengeance. Hers is vengeance. like vengeance against all Gurkle. And we can get into the chapter, but yeah. She's my favorite. She's my favorite character.
She actually your favorite? This is your favorite character?
Yes, she is, yeah.
Oh, that's cool. How do we feel about the name Gurkle, by the way? I struggle with that one.
I hate saying it. I don't know why.
Gurkle. It's very
Gurkle.
Did I do that? It's very Family Matters.
Yes.
No.
I mean, literally is very that. I mean, I'm sure it gets cool. I'm sure I'll learn to love it. Right now, it's a little bit like these guys tortured.
All right. I guess in our last chapter, right, we had Logan and Baez and the like ever incompetent Kwai going out traveling, and they got ambushed by Black Toe and his thugs, a named man, and were completely destroyed and immolated by Baez's magic and a little of Logan's combat cunning.
Yes.
It was pretty cool to see some big old magic, and they were all being looked at by a long eye.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Probably all looked at by the long eye through a cow rib, you know, Bethod's seer. But now we're at chapter 18.
Yeah.
Freedom looks like.
I think it's chapter 19, but it doesn't matter.
But it's what freedom looks like. And what we see looks like is a shovel digging into some hard earth to bury your mates after a big old fight with some Gurkle bastards.
Yeah, and I loved this scene too. Yeah, Gurkish. Yeah, but I loved this scene because I mean, Peter, you mentioned it, but there, you know, the similarity between Logan and Pharaoh, it is pretty immediate. But they both have weird rules, right? And Logan's are like only practical, and hers are weirdly sentimental, right? Like, there's no benefit to her by digging in the graves, like, but she does it anyway because that's just what you do, which I found pretty interesting character-wise. Like, Logan, I don't think would ever dig a grave. It just wouldn't be worth his while.
I mean, but there's something interesting about how hard the earth is described, how difficult the digging is, and the fact that Pharaoh is pretty clear about they're being followed by, like, a lot more people. Like, it's even mentioned that, like, what, they don't
or
have,
not
like,
they
much
at
food
this point,
or water.
But she...
Yeah, she knows she's being chased. I mean, she mentions that the people chasing didn't have like much food or water.
That's a little bit later, yeah.
But either way, the idea, I'm just speaking to the sentimental idea, the idea that you're digging through not easy dirt to dig through, to bury the bodies, while knowing that she's being chased. I mean, she could be getting moving ahead. And I do get the feeling that Logan would be, you know, back to the mud.
I didn't remember that Pharaoh had companions, and we learned a little bit more about her sort of erstwhile companions in even like a few paragraphs, but it's funny to think that she traveled with anyone ever.
Yeah, agreed.
She hated them though. These were companions of necessity.
So she escaped from Gurkish confines, like some Gurkle slaver camp is what we can put together, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
something like that. Yeah, I'm not as certain, but yeah, you know more about Gurkle than I do, so that makes sense.
Well, I'm not totally either. Again, as we've said every time, Peter has never read these books. I am revisiting this book for the first time in a long time, and then Ian, you know a little bit more about what's going on.
I was under the impression, and again, I know nothing about Gurkle, so it was just like my first impression was that it was some kind of like maid work or something shit like that. Like something that it didn't seem like hard labor. It seemed more like just labor not fitting to Pharaoh's personality, degrading to.
No, she was a slave.
I think she was a proper slave.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So she's burying some people, and one of them turns out to be a rapist and a monster criminal and like a thief.
Yep.
So she's doing this burying in the desert. They've slaughtered her and her companions, slaughtered 10 Gurkish guard or whatever, and a guy comes up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yahweh, God himself, showing up.
Uwe. Okay. All right.
Yahweh shows up, is like, that's a nice sword you took from that guard over there.
And it is a cool sword. I like that. I like her just swinging that. So she gets like a matching sword and dagger.
Well balanced. Yeah.
A scimitar or something.
Also, Pacey's Yulwei is incredible.
Yulwei.
Just like regal, beautiful, deep voice. And also Yulwei looks super fucking cool. Like he's like covered in pouches and like bangles and has these long gray dreads, and he's like super tall. He just, I just imagine him looking amazing.
It's a good description. It's a good reading of the character. I feel the same. Yeah, it was.
He seems very sexy, like old man sexy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And I love all the pouches. I just always give me pouches.
Yeah, what's in those? What do you even think? That's why I love like Deadpool and shit, right? Like the 90s comics.
Yeah, he's a lot like Deadpool, Peter. Yeah.
I loved with the part where like he looked at the camera.
Yeah, yes.
Yulway, not Yahweh. Like, yeah. I'm not God, and winked. That was funny.
Yeah, very funny. Very funny. Very it's pertinent. It's very relevant.
Book. You know what, Peter? You're totally right. That's what I get when I come at you. You're too clever. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a regular Audie West. So
bam.
Thank you. Bam. I am drinking. After all,
well, I guess we're all audience in this episode. This cool looking dude who came out of nowhere with a bunch of bangles that she later like recognizes. Oh, if he moved here, they would have been jangling. And so he didn't really move like into her like range of hearing or periphery or anything. He just started talking and he's there. And so she is very cool and notches an arrow and shoots at him. And then it misses.
Right. So he's got level one, like, what is it called? Like Misty Step or.
It's not that. It's just things don't hit him.
But he's got at least the seventh level teleport.
He doesn't teleport. That's.
No, well, he gets there by teleporting, right? He doesn't make any noise.
No, right. So he does have that, but the arrow is like just misguided. Like it just is confused a little bit and swerves out of the way.
But that's like a level one or two spell, like compared to just teleporting there. That's like.
Yeah, yeah.
I do love that they never really go into the mechanics of the magic so much with Yulway. Like, he does just kind of bend reality like around him.
Wait. So do you mean, like, when you say that, are you saying, like, it's not like Baez? Like, you're saying, like, do they go into the mechanics of Baez magic compared to Yulway? Is it, like, different?
A little bit more.
Yeah.
But not much. Yeah. They don't go much into the magic. And, Peter, but it's not really a spoiler, like, a lot of the magic is jettisoned in the later books. Like, they don't become magic focused books.
I don't know about that.
I remember Gus, you saying like one of the things you liked about the series was like the mechanics of the world, which and you talked at the same time about Patrick Rothfuss and you didn't compare the two directly, but I was under the impression that we'd be getting some like deep descriptions of how everything puts together. Cause you know, like the description of sympathy in that book, it's one of the joys of that series. It's like,
no, right. That's somebody mechanics. Or with like Brandon Sanderson or like people that grew up playing D&D who love systems. This is not that at all. This book is not that at all. Like, we do not ever get a breakdown of the magic systems.
Okay, good. So my joke about always comparing it to D&D spell levels is extra funny then. That's good.
So Yulway.
So can I jump in for a second? With this scene, I love that Pharaoh just keeps trying to kill Yulway. Mm-hmm. It seems so insane. Like, clearly he's there for a reason. He wants something from her, maybe to give her something, but she's just like so convinced of the terrors of the world that like her only response to anything is just murdering it immediately. So she tries to kill him four times.
Yeah, how could you not? It's a big powerful wizard showing up. It's like, well, okay.
Well, she shoots two arrows. The first one, she's like, well, I it's possible I could miss. I've never missed, but maybe I miss this time. She shoots a second one. She's like, nope, something's fucked up. Then she does like a surreptitious knife pull and he's gone. And then she like pads around him in like a cool, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Like she's like through the sand and then tries to knife him back in like his new alignment of his neck. And he's also gone.
And the dagger turns into a snake.
Well, that's the next one is that then.
Is it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then she tries to attack him after he's already talked to her again. And it turns into a snake and she stamps on it. And no, it's her dagger.
Some real Dumbledore energy coming off this guy, for sure.
Well, he's like an obfuscator. He's like an illusionist obfuscator style mage.
Got it. Mysterio. Some real Mysterio energy coming off this
guy. With some like also big transport powers.
Mm, gotcha. I don't know a transporter.
Well,
reference.
No, I sorry, that was not
it. Looper. Specific. Looper. Got some mysterious.
He means Jason Statham powers.
No, I mean Jumper.
Jumper. Thank you. Jumper plus mysterious. So we've got what is it? A little bit of Jake Gyllenhaal with a little bit of Hayden Christensen on this guy, but old with dreadlocks and dark skin. Well, so I don't know.
I don't even
I've never read these books before. This is my
Jake Gyllenhaal. Where did he come from?
He was Mysterio in that one movie. I think.
Right. Okay. Yeah, he was.
I apologize profusely. I'm sorry for this. Shit.
Yeah, well, I'll edit it out.
That's fine. Good. Thank you.
So then Yulway asks, well, essentially they start talking and it comes up that there's people looking for her.
And she escaped from somewhere.
And he basically goes into this description of what they will do to her if she gets captured. I just thought it was just a reminder of how brutal like the world that these characters exist in is. Like he says, like they'll break your legs with hammers in the town square, and it's just like just that touch of like with hammers.
Break your knees with hammers. I feel like it's knees, which I
maybe it's knees. Yeah. So you can never run again.
It's a horrible sounding thing. Just break your patellas with hammers, like ugh.
And then hang her from a cage.
Everybody will love it. Like everybody will want to see more. It's horrible.
In front of the Emperor's Palace. Yeah. It's like there is a obviously they talk about the cage in front of the Emperor's Palace. So there was a big spectacle cage.
Yeah.
That people are made examples of in front of.
And it also sounds very it's pretty clear that like no one defies the Emperor. And she's the only one who has, and she's kind of gained a legendary like aspect from it.
Sure.
And so the Emperor wants to find her to make an example of her is what Yulway is saying.
Okay, so Yulway presents an option that he can do some travel. He knows how to travel in this landscape. She's thinking about going into, so they're in the Badlands already. Like they're already in withered, anemic lands of Gurkul.
Yeah, hard dirt Badlands. And she pegs immediately that Yulway is from like past the deserts in the south, which are impassable, basically.
Right. And he's also very dark skinned. So it's like he's someone from the Southern Empire. But she was thinking about either staying here and living off the very limited resources of the Badlands or going into the shifting desert, which
to die, horror. Essentially.
Yeah.
There's one option, though, ultimately. Like we find that later. It's like you go into the desert because otherwise you're being hunted down throughout the Badlands. And it seems like Pharaoh has a boon right now of having the collective water of all of the companions. That's a lot. But
she can't carry that much.
Right. So she spits it out onto the ground, right? Like she pours it over her hair.
Oh, yeah. That's a great point where
the soldier, like the soldier who's near death, surprising Pharaoh and begging for more. That's exactly when Yulway shows up, right? Like is in the middle of the soldier begging for water as she makes a show of wasting it on herself, basically.
Oh, she's the best. The best, the best.
Have you heard my name? Do you know who Pharaoh is?
It sounds like they've been outlaws for a long time. Like Pharaoh has like developed a reputation for like cold and ruthless killings. And the Emperor refuses to let her live because of that.
Okay, interesting.
So Yulway is trying to get her to travel with him. And he talks about having sort of different ways of traveling, what we can imply are part of his mage powers other than just dodging arrows. He also mentions the Eaters.
Yes.
For the first time. You know, Peter, you haven't heard about them before, but...
No, it was cool. I had an image of them immediately in my head. Yeah, it was scary.
Because he says, like, there are a ton of soldiers you cannot fight. There's no way to possibly win against. And she's like, well, I could run away. And he's like, well, run where? And she's like, well, I could kill them. And he's like, well, it's not just them. And she's like, oh, is it priests? He's like, that and more, you know, and then mentions the Eaters, that there are some Eaters. And that shocks her. That shocks her out of her sort of confidence of... just killing everything or running away from everything or doing whatever she's so competent at. So Eaters are something else we learn.
Yeah, I love it. I love the name. It's such a like spicy,
it's spicy
name you can get immediately. Right. I especially love it because we're coming off of the last chapter of part one, where like, what's the second law of like not?
Yes, I wasn't going like to say it, but I'm so happy you brought it up, Peter. Yes, yes, I didn't want to ruin
it. We'll say nothing more on that, but yeah.
Oh,
it's
I'm
forbidden
right.
to eat the
oh,
flesh
that feels
of men.
Good. Wow. Okay. Cool.
So she wants to run to the desert. He stops her, and he's like, "Well, let's maybe camp out somewhere more serene." And she's like, "No, I want to watch the vultures eat." And so she just basically wants to sit and like make camp in the place with all these dead bodies. And she's like,
"I love it." Vultures. These are two forms of sentiment right off the bat. Yeah. We got the sentiment of wanting to bury your friends and the sentiment of wanting to watch these bastards.
The vultures must eat. Somebody must feed the vultures.
And she knows there's a fucking army camp like nearby. Like she knows by searching their gear and stuff that they don't have the supplies for this to be the only people. Like,
but it is also done. Like established she's that it's irrelevant where they would camp.
Yeah, she's ready to die. It's over. And she wants to return to the mud. It's fire.
So night approaches. At this point, she sort of recognizes that she knows that Yulwe has some significant magic and knows that she's kind of in his hands. And she's like, "But what do you want from me?" He's like, a favor. Maybe later. I'll do a favor for you." You know, which is the worst thing to a Magi, if he is in fact a Magi, which who knows?
He'd be really lucky. He didn't get hit by those arrows, and like he put the bangles on later.
Yeah, what is it? Longshot, the Marvel character, who's just very, very lucky.
That's a domino energy.
She and Uwe camp out, and there was a like half circle of campfires they see because they're on top of a hill, I presume.
Yeah. There are these two camps, and one has a bunch of fires, and one has less.
No, it's one half circle camp, and they're going to the left.
I know, I agree with you, Gus, but I feel like all the fires were on the right, and they went to the right.
I had a hard time with my right and my left my entire life.
Okay, so there's one camp, and on one side is a bunch of fires, and on the other side is many less fires. And Pharaoh says, "Well, we should obviously go to the ones with the less fires." And Yulwe says, "Well, they expected you to do that. There's more people around those fires. And then there's also someone else, you know, like dun, dun, dun." So they go through the one with the more fires. And as they're walking through, like it becomes very apparent that like Pharaoh's being protected by Yulwe's spell and no one can see them or hear them because Yulwe's talking very loudly and Pharaoh is freaked the fuck out by it, like on edge immediately. But when she realizes that no one can see them, she starts sneaking up on this band of three men sitting around this fire.
It's classic obfuscation magic. It's like, as long as you don't shout in their ear, they won't know you're there. Like, it's not true invisibility.
But if you take an attack action, you lose it.
Basically.
Literally, and it's like literally, like I make a joke about talking about D&D magic in this. This is the only time it really literally felt like that. Like, she walks up to the fire, where there are these three people talking, where they talk about like a grizzled veteran, like some kind of green newbie and somebody who's skinny. And she gets up to them ready to fucking kill them, like staring right in their eye.
So they are talking about her.
Yes, yes.
That's what draws her, because they are talking about the legend of Pharaoh Mel'jin a little bit. And it's like she cuts out, like if you're hot, she cuts off your dick and eats it in front of you. I mean, that is one of the things.
I love this scene. Basically, they're trying to scare the younger recruit. Right. And one of the guys says, "She's killed 100 men. She'll cut your fruits off. She eats them in front of you. She kills women and children." And Pharaoh just says, "Well, I've never killed children," which implies that she's done all of the other things. I loved it. Yeah.
But what brings her, so she sort of comes closer, and then what brings her to attack mode is the young recruit who is a father talks about like, "Well, no, I got a wife and a kid at home." And we learn that she's lost a huge amount of family. And she's like, "These people took everything possible away from me." I mean, we learn a little bit about her recklessness and her belligerence, where she just wants to kill this dude because he mentioned a family, who's somebody who took family away from her in the most adjunct way possible.
Totally. I mean, and it's a reminder like of when Yulwe asked her earlier, like, "What do you want?" And she just says vengeance. And you can kind of hear her realizing how hollow that is. And seeing someone who has the beauty of something to look forward to and to go back to, like, just infuriates her. And she walks up to him and she essentially like, I think she pulls out a knife. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah.
No, she pulls out like the shiny new knife she got from Gurkish captain.
And she says something loud enough that the young one like stands up and looks right at her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this guy basically stands up, looks right at her, but it's clear that he's looking through her and past her. And she's so tempted to fucking murder this guy. Because
but Yulwei does call her off. Like he shouts at her, which like he's shouting and they don't hear him.
Yeah.
And then
the spell wear off. Yep.
It's cool. And the guy that was egging the younger guy on basically stands up and points at Pharaoh.
He does a bit
and says, like, yeah.
There she is. She's right there, right in front of your eyes.
It's
and she's like, do I have to murder everyone now? And then we realize
it turns out, that he's just making fun of him for looking, but it's so coincidental. I mean, my guess would be that he saw a flicker that inspired him to be a jackass, but he thought it a little bit.
It's a like funny book, guys. It's just a funny book. Don't ever think it. It's funny.
But don't you think he thought it a little bit?
No, I didn't think that. I literally just thought this is a aha gotcha for the audience.
Okay.
I mean, I believe you. You've read more of the books.
Well, no, I just think in the world, like building out into the world, like he saw like just a slip of the spell. Like she just flickered into existence and he jumped up and then did a thing and played it off as a joke.
Got a little inspiration from seeing the whispers of Pharaoh right there. Sure.
Yeah, and then there was like, oh no, I was being convinced by the paranoia of my, you know, green recruit.
And I was already fucking with him. Yeah. I love to make a meme. I get it. Yeah. That makes sense.
She pulls back, they slip to the camp unmolested, and Pharaoh slips then into a despair.
Yeah. I mean, basically she says, there's nothing left of me, you know, there's nothing left of me. I'm empty, you know? And also, by the way, Pharaoh is the only one in these entire books with a French accent.
Yeah. It's like an Algerian French.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So there's nothing left of her. And Yulwei, which in a very corny line, I really hated this, but whatever.
Yeah. I don't get the line. Cause he's like, I was beginning to think there was nothing left of you. And it's like, well, what do you mean? What redeemed that from that action? Just that she's like fucked up.
I think it's that she didn't kill the guy is the implication. That in his mind implies that she might be worth saving or something.
That's so dumb.
Yeah. Agreed. I didn't like it, but yeah.
Wait, is it not because like she was ready to die? Like she had no options. She was ready to die. And now
in her complete collapse, he saw something to be saved.
I mean, either way,
I like that. I like that version better. I hope it's that one.
I mean, it's a great line because look at all the discourse we're getting out of it. And then there's the next chapter after that. There's two more chapters to go.
There's two more chapters,
only
guys.
Two.
And then the book's over.
We can do it. We can do
it. The next, the King's Justice, a Giselle chapter. I got to say, if we're moving on, are we ready to move on?
We're so ready. We're so ready.
I got to say, this is one of my favorite chapters. But we'll get there. We'll get there. This is a good chapter. We get a lot happening in this chapter. This and next chapter. Yeah. This is a two-part series. This is a season finale, even though it's the beginning of part two. I'm excited about it.
We also get like Glockta's like coming out party. We get like it's Glockta bitch. You know, like it's Brittany. Like it's Glockta bitch. Yeah. Like,
sure.
It's awesome.
But we'll get there because like that's a little bit of a
quinceañera. Chapter 20, The King's Justice. So Giselle, our favorite dude, Peter's favorite character of all time, arrives to the Lord's Round to do his normal guarding thing. He meets his dumb fucking buddy, Jalenhorn.
Yep. Jalenhorn, who was horny for that one rich person that one time. And would play cards with him. And Glockta knew his name. That's
her name was like Countess or something. Countess.
And Glockta did his homework and knew his name. There's like Jalenhorn is identified through Jalenhorn being horny and or surprised by other characters. We know basically nothing about him.
And like in one of the richer, dumber noble. Like he's the well-intentioned dumb noble.
No, no, that's not true. That's the guy whose name starts with a C. I can't remember. That's the rich, dumb noble. Jalenhorm literally is just around. We hear like nothing about Jalenhorm. Is that wrong? Am I wrong? I feel like he's just around.
Yeah, he's
kind of the fact that we don't remember.
He essentially comes in when the plot needs another character throughout these books.
Yeah, somebody not as specific as
right.
Weth.
And he is, yeah. What we can say is that he's deeply unspecific.
He's a big dumb lieutenant. Yeah.
So all the powerful nobles assemble. It's a Lord's Round. It's unprecedented that Huygens, who are the other
Brock,
big ones?
Brock, Isher, yeah. And what's a Barrison?
Barrison. Yeah, Barrison. Yeah.
But the idea is that like usually it's like the second or third sons of these families that show up. Like this is a fucking deal. This one.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. Something's afoot, guys.
Yeah. Cause Hoff called like a important meeting. He flagged everybody's memos with must attend.
Right. When open council meetings are not important by definition.
Oh, and no one. Yeah. And no one shows. It's all like empty seats. And this one is packed to the gills.
Which is crazy because as much as we've seen that, like, none of them are important, the two open council sessions we've seen so far were pretty fucking important.
Very important.
So it's like, no one cared about those. Like, no one cared about, like, fucking Fenris the Feared.
Actual important politics as opposed to fake garbage. I mean, this is all fake news.
The fact that, like, they were calling everybody, I was like, oh, are they going to declare war against the North?
I know. And I
was like, no, they're not. I knew it immediately because I was like, no, they wouldn't give a shit about that because they didn't give a shit about Fenris and they didn't give a shit about any of this. Yeah, I was excited to see what happened.
So they assemble and Hoff sort of strolls out and he is flanked by Salt, the High Inquisitor, and then High Justice Morovia, who is just a hobbled old dude.
Yeah, the man of the people. But I think, Gus, as you mentioned before, by man of the people, it means man of the rich people who are not nobles.
Right.
Right. He is not a peasant's champion.
And then Hoff immediately orders a drink.
Yeah, and then he's like, Salt, you want to take care of this? And Salt is like, oh, yes.
Well, I think that it's a little bit of a bummer for Peter because the old speaker is gone.
I do hate that. Yes. I loved the announcer who just pissed everybody off. I love the idea of that character. That is the funniest character that can exist. Somebody who's has a purposeless job and everyone has to deal with it. I feel like Joe Abercrombie decided that we're done with this joke and wrote him out of the book.
Yep, that's true. But he was a fun windbag. Like, I mean, his sentences on introducing people were so attenuated. It was delightful. But it's also plausible for an important meeting they get someone who can actually announce things with some degree of concision.
I mean, or Hoff killed him, or that happened. Hoff
had
it's also totally
maybe that version. Yeah.
But Hoff is chill. I
love Hoff.
My hot take from this reread is Hoff is maybe my favorite character.
He's funny. Give him like an animal sidekick and I'd read a book just about him.
Oh, yeah. He's totally indifferent. Just drinking. Just like pretty set up in his position. Doesn't give a shit. Obviously corrupt like as much as a person can be, but just doesn't care.
Well, I feel like he's is he corrupt? I feel like he has principles. They're just awful principles. Like he believes
in his principle is that he doesn't want to be bothered.
Yeah, his principle is I'm a noble, I'm important, fuck everybody else. I'm going to get drunk cuz I'm tired of dealing with you ingrates. It's big 2020 energy, guys.
That's true.
So the nobles are outraged by Hoff. Or no, Salt calumnizes the merchants.
Yeah, basically Salt walks down Hoff hands it off to Salt and Salt walks down and basically says, the Honorable Guild of Mercers have done many things, many great things, and then the Mercers are like, yeah, they have. And then Salt does a nice little heel turn, looks over his shoulder. He's like,
and they're
like
also
defrauding the king.
Treasonous.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh, heavens to Betsy. It was, it was
pretty crazy.
It was the quickest heel turn. It wasn't as clever as Salt thought it was.
Exactly.
It was pretty funny.
Like, obviously, he had rehearsed this for, like, at least a few days in the mirror, like, moment of, like,
honorable
turning around.
For, honorable for me to poop on. It was definitely garbage.
Cool.
And basically...
pertinent reference. Honorable for me to poop on! Just
trying to keep it fresh, my friends. Trying to keep it fresh.
Fuck.
But then, to emphasize the point, Inquisitor Glockta walks out parading Salem.
Well, no, not yet. No, the nobles.
Wait, really? Okay, sorry.
Okay. So the nobles, they have a bit of an outrage. Brock says, in particular, the merchants won them the Gurkish War, which I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that was interesting. I thought the same thing. What does that mean? Because everyone agreed with that. And it was why they gave them
by the mechanisms of trade.
But they gave them the exclusive contract because of that. And
yes,
there's an implication
did.
That they're going to give other people the contract. It's like, who? These are the merchants. Like, who else? Anyway, we'll get to that later. Because after what we've heard about the Gurkish, I'm not thinking like sanctions are working against them.
We find a little bit out in the next chapter about that. I'll mention it when we get to it. But
okay.
Yeah.
I didn't pick that up at all.
So initially, the cadre of important nobles stand up and have an issue with anything that Hoff could bring against the Merchant Guild.
Yeah, there's a lot of jowls and see here. What are you, the merchants? Yeah, it was good.
And then we get the It's Glockta Bitch scene. And Giselle hears, like, he's like, oh, is that Click Tap Pain coming? And then Glock's just like, oh, yeah, baby. And he walks in. He's having his moment. He's a little more upright than he usually is. Like, it's his time. It's his time to shine. And he
hasn't been in front of people since he was in the contest or something.
Exactly. Like, yeah. This is his coming out. This is his reintroduction to society as a total villain, which is amazing.
I got to put Giselle down. Like right to Giselle's face last time we were with Giselle, and now he gets to do it in front of everybody. He's coming out, and he is not nervous about it. He's excited to give a little show here, knowing everybody's like, "Oh, that guy." Everybody coming out sucks, according to these people too. We've got Glockta, Ruse, Carpy, Hornlock, and Frost. All of them look like tortured and horrible and freakish. I love this procession. It's so funny to imagine all these people being miserable at this moment. Is Glockta's other practical even there? Is Severard even there? I think it's mentioned. It's not. So it feels purposeful. Like, because Severard could have just been a dude. No, let's get the albino freak.
I mean, I don't know if I don't think he's there. I mean, he's not mentioned. Frost is there. He's the enforcer.
I just love the procession. Where it's like each person is worse than the person coming before.
Yeah. And so basically Glockta brings them out and we get Salem Ruse and your boy Giselle is immediately like, oh fuck. Like I know this guy and he used to have dinner with my father.
It is it's the second best Giselle moment in the book. The first best is coming this chapter. I laughed out loud when he was like, Salem, first off, the reason I say they're all terrible is that Salem Ruse, Carpy, and Hornlock are clearly have been tortured horribly.
Like, oh my God.
In terrible shape. And Ruse comes out and Giselle first goes, I know that guy. He had dinner with my dad.
He was my
that
dad's best friend.
A traitor. He's like that traitor. He immediately is like, he's a traitor. I hate him.
He literally says, "How dare he be a traitor?"
Yeah, there was no level of like, wait, I know that man. He's a good man, or like my father's a good judge of character. It's like, oh, the state says he's a traitor. They're right. I hate him for the implications this could have for me. Oh,
it seems like post 9/11, like America, where you cannot breathe a word of dissension. And if you even try to change the narrative at all, it's treason.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And he says treason is contagious, right? Like accusations, they'll, you know.
Right. That's why his whole thing is like he's furious, not for king and country, believes it. And is furious just out of the sake of his father and himself.
Sure.
I love it.
Ruse, this horribly tortured man, is going to fuck up Giselle's social climbing by being tortured and terrible.
And to remind everybody, this is a Giselle POV chapter. So we're seeing in his head his truest thoughts. And
yes.
His thoughts immediately go to the most selfish, shitty place of like, oh, my family friend. Fuck him for being a traitor immediately.
Right.
There's no idea given to the idea that this might be wrong, that I know this man and he's a good man.
I have a prediction about what your first favorite line is going to be, but we'll get to that. I want to see if it's the right one.
Glocka makes Ruse sing, and then Ruse goes after Carpi. Like, he's like, well, that's the assassin that tried to kill me right next to him. And Carpi is, I mean, all in all, Ruse comes out pretty sweet on this deal, because Carpi is bludgeoned.
Brutalized.
And, I mean, has no brain anymore.
Yeah.
Ruse is really useful because Ruse was the first person to name names. And then there was an attempted assassination against him. So it just looks really good. It honestly, the case starts out looking a little reasonable, with Ruse being like, I had a crisis of conscience and wanted to tell everybody. And they tried to kill me.
Because Ruse is semi-cogent and the rest of them are.
Oh, it's downhill from here.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, everything after this hurts the case, to be honest. But then Carpi starts talking.
Yeah, and he's got that pink spittle. It's like blood leaking into his fucking mouth or whatever. And
he's
missing
the same teeth that Glocked is missing.
Yes. And he basically recites what he's been told to say, which is that he was hired by the next man, who is Gofred Hornlach, to assassinate Salem Ruse.
Yeah.
And then we cut to the worst of the three, which is Gofred Hornlach. And he is like clearly he's in his own world.
PTSD, horrified. Yes.
And then Glocta says, what is your name? Yeah, Glocta says, what is your name? And then he just snaps back to like the horrors of what Glocta has done to him.
Right.
And
it reminded me of like how dogs are trained.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or like a road between two. Is it good job, dentists? Good. I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah, and he was really looking for a means of escape. Really, though.
I'm
just
clapping,
like,
Peter. I'm clapping for you. Yes.
Thank you, Ian. It was pretty scary because he was just looking around like a madman. And this is a powerful person here, in like very powerful. And just starts repeating the same story over and over again to the point where Glock has to be like, stop. Stop it.
No, right. He's like a broken record. It is hard to read a little bit. Like, it's sort of fun when Glockta's getting his like his game on with these people, but the result is awful.
And bullshit. It's bullshit. And I gotta give it to the, who was it, Brent? Who was it?
Brock.
Gotta give it to Brock for being like, these people have been tortured. You're not buying this, right? This
so
is
crazy.
So then
basically, yeah, they
can
all
we,
finger.
Can we sit on that line for a second? Just 1 sec, because I remember that line and I remember Salt's response to it, like sending a fucking shiver down my spine, because it reminds me of everything that happens in essentially like the conquest of empire, where he says these men have clearly been tortured, and Salt says, well, what would you have us do with traitors, right? And it's like,
I wanted to hit the thing before that.
Oh, go ahead.
They're all fingering Colt, who is the highest, like the highest of the Mercer Guild. That's the whole point. They're trying to railroad Magister Colt.
Totally. And they issue a warrant for Colt's arrest on the spot.
After that, that's when Brock speaks up.
That Salt line, though, is really even more powerful after Giselle being like, oh, this person's here. They're a traitor. How dare they? In a way that I definitely found comical, but like, yeah, that Salt line afterwards, it's really reinforced by that. That like, I think Salt is a manipulator for sure. And he's a machinator. He has ideas of what to do.
Of course.
But enough people like Giselle, who isn't totally an idiot, is like, yeah, I agree with that. Like, we know that their first reaction is like, fuck these people. That's real. The implications that are really scary. And it makes a lot of sense why Brock says the only reasonable thing, these people have been tortured, but all of the other people that were curious, they're all quiet. They're shifty eyed. They look left and right. It's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was going to say it's, I mean, Gus, you mentioned 9/11, but there's like weird echoes of it. But I mean, essentially, like when Salt says that, like what we almost forget in that moment is that like the Inquisition like invented this, right? Like right. They went out of their way to make this into a thing. And then by inflating what they wanted people to think had happened, it justified their essential, like the horrific things that they could do.
Right.
You know, because of that
assassination attempt, which is probably the most damning evidence.
But the assassination contempt was only, it was put into place by Salt, like putting ruse out there, you know, as bait. Like,
yeah, the mercenaries went to the Open Council. They were like, we have to do something about the Inquisitors coming after us. This is bullshit. And they hired an assassin specifically because Hoff was just like, fuck you, you're not noble-blooded, and took a drink of wine. This is totally the fault of the system. It's Salt, but it's Salt understanding the anger that like the nobles have toward the Mercers and knowing that most of them will turn a blind eye to this, that they're fine with this. These aren't noble houses. It's fucked. It's really fucked.
It's also like, it's Salt casting aspersions on Brock's sense of honor within the kingdom, right? He's like, but you know, how Brock's like, these men have clearly been tortured. And Salt's essentially like, well, Brock, like if you cared enough about the king, you'd obviously do the same, wouldn't you? Like it just, right. it's so horrible. And it just happens all the time in our world.
Yeah.
But so Brock and the rest of the quiet nobles, I mean, people are still pissed off. They're just side-eyeing at this point. They appeal to High Justice Moravia.
Only Brock. Nobody jumps on his bandwagon. Like it's a shame. Like all the other high nobles are totally disinterested because they've seen the torture. That like that's the whole point of that.
Disinterested or scared? They're pissed about this. They're scared. It's not disinterest, right?
Well, no, they're pretending disinterest because they're terrified.
And High Justice Moravia is even among them, despite the fact that he's amongst the close council. He's the biggest.
Yeah, I don't know really what his position is.
He was quiet. He was quiet and saying nothing.
We get a little bit of Moravia in this where he basically, Brock says, like, no reasonable man would stand for this. And Moravia says, it hasn't been a day for reasonable men, which implies that in the closed council meeting, Moravia was outvoted.
Right, that the decision had been made, you know.
Right, and Moravia perceives himself as the reasonable man.
Yeah, the warrant was already put out. All they're doing here really is making the case to all the nobles in the open council. Like, there's no decision being made here. So Moravia, what's the point of saying anything?
Maybe I'm just repeating myself, but Moravia is essentially saying, he's letting us know and Brock know that he wanted to go the other way.
Right.
Didn't want to arrest the Mercers. Just to make that clear.
Like, if there was a case to be made, Moravia already made it. It's not
exactly
for the nobles,
yes.
It was for the closed council.
And the big difference is he says he is the authority of the king, or Hoff says like that cuts you off at the ankles. Like he has the king's consent, which is just definitive.
And that's when, you know, they brandish like the warrant outright. And Jalenhorm, everybody's favorite, like noticeable, big deal Jalenhorm, is ordered to help Glockta go and serve the warrant.
Yeah, take that guy out of his office.
Oh, yeah.
So it all goes off without a hitch. And it's a pretty good meeting for our protagonist, Glockta, the guy we all love.
The fact that it's not his POV. So let's get back to the good meat of the story where Dale looks up from his spot and he spots Artie West.
No, he goes out. He leaves the hall.
Oh, is that where? Well, either way, he spots Artie West. And Artie West,
Brand.
Fuck Artie West at this point. Artie like called him out in a brutal way, and she's hot while doing it. That sucks ass.
That's offensive.
Totally over her. Still, like, I don't know. It's nice to see.
They haven't talked for like at least a couple days.
Well, he feels like she's been punished long enough by his absence.
Right. I do love the idea of like, I'm over you, but like, I like seeing you, but it doesn't mean anything. And like, you deserve to be around me. But then who is Artie with? Lieutenant Brint, that little motherfucker who lost the card game in the first chapter we see Giselle in. And man, Artie's having a great time. She's laughing. She's being charming.
She does that arm touch.
And Lieutenant Brint and Artie, like, they have a conversation with Giselle, and Giselle chooses the least graceful way of addressing it, right? Like, Brent is like, Giselle, hi. It's like, Captain Luther to you, you mother.
Oh, it's so bad.
And like, and thinking to himself, like, ah, I've nailed this one. I mean, I think, I don't remember if it's here, if it's a second later, but Giselle has the thought that is utterly true, which is, I wonder if Artie did this to make me angry.
Right.
And he's like, no, couldn't have. That well, is the best moment of the book so far.
He comes to the conclusion that she did not orchestrate it because she smiled at him. Like, that's
right. It's amazing.
It's as simple as that.
It's amazing. It's like, he calls it, she's trying to make me jealous and get under my skin and piss me off because Lieutenant Brent sucks ass. And he calls it and then gives up on it immediately because he's like, well, she is hot. And
right.
I do like that.
Yeah, that's it. It's
awesome. Yeah. So he yells at Giselle, is like, he yells at Brent and is like, I showed Brent. I did a great job. Like, I've never seen so many misplays in my entire life.
Oh, he's the worst.
From the perspective of somebody who nailed every single move. It's the funniest closing chapter. I meant to listen to it again before we talked about this because I had the time of my life listening to the last like 5 minutes of this chapter, but I ran out of time, probably because I was drinking. It was great. I can't wait to go back and fall asleep to it.
Double
later.
Hoff.
Oh yeah, I was pulling a Hoff and I couldn't get there. Man. And what's the last line? How's it end? It's like, she is amazing. If only she was well-bred and had money. Right.
Right. And no, but Audie's just like chill as fuck. She says, how's the fencing? And he's like, well, how's the drinking? And she says, well, if it was a competition, I would beat the shit out of you.
He's like, wow, that was so funny.
It was funny.
It was just the idea that like, oh, I'd marry you right now if you were rich.
If you important. Yeah. If you had blood and money or a lot of money.
I think it was like, if you had blood and money would be nice, right? Like a lot of money.
We also get like a glimpse into Artie that we haven't seen before, where like she used Brent and there's she gives a self-satisfied smirk that Giselle kind of catches. And it's like right. The first hint of cruelty from Artie.
Well, not the first.
No, for sure. It's the first.
Okay. How about this? It's the first sign that isn't directed at Giselle, who totally deserves it. How about that?
Yeah, and I think everything she said to him in the last encounter, I don't think it was cruel. I think it was like very justified, very clear, like almost dismissive. But like this is orchestrated. Like she found Brent,
sure.
She brought him there in order to use him to get Giselle to come over. Like there's a whole
maybe.
There's a, you know, there's a calculated mind
that definitely happened. I know that definitively. Like whether or not. I think it's pretty clear that Artie doesn't give a shit about Brent, specifically did this knowing that Brent would be the person of all sure. people that Giselle thinks is utter gutter trash.
Also, and, just to be clear, I love that she's cruel.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think it makes her a better character.
It's
yeah.
great.
She's the best.
She sees through it. I mean, my only thing is that whether or not we love or hate Giselle, and I know we're all stands here, the last time, like, Artie was, like, unnecessarily brutal to Giselle in a moment where he was trying to figure something out. Like, Giselle deserves it because Giselle deserves everything coming to him. But it was still, like, targeted and brutal. Like, Artie knew exactly what buttons to push to fuck with him. And now we have poor old Brent.
I know. I felt so bad for Brent.
Have you guys... This is going to get cut out of the podcast. Have you guys seen the movie Freddy Got Fingered?
I never saw it.
It's Gus? Okay. First off, it's worth seeing. But the only reason I bring it up is because there's a child in that movie. And the only purpose of that child is the child keeps getting wounded egregiously, horribly, as like a joke. That feels like Brent in this book.
Freddy Got Fingered?
Yeah, dude.
Is that a movie?
Yeah, it's a Tom Green movie.
I don't know it.
I can see your expression in Freddy the way got you're speaking fingered? Right now.
Is the name of a movie?
Wait, Gus. You don't know that's a movie?
No.
It's the Tom Green movie that like everyone hates.
I barely know who Tom Green is.
It's a horrible title for a movie.
I honestly, I had never seen it before.
Disgusting.
I've seen it twice in the last 2 years. It's kind
you,
of
wait, you've seen it twice in the last 2 years?
I'd never seen it before this. I will say the movie was definitely smarter than people were ready for at the time.
Well, with a title like that, I mean the bar is pretty fucking low.
It's a deconstruction of how bullshit like Hollywood is, but unfortunately it was made in a time where it needed lots of Tom Green's jokes that bring the movie down. If you could boil the movie into a 15-minute short, it would be like a legendary short. Anyway,
okay.
We don't need to keep going on.
I don't really know who Tom Green is totally either, but
does Freddie get fingered?
No. And okay. Eddie is Tom Green's brother in the movie. And it's crazy that the title of the movie is that, because it's maybe 3 minutes of the movie is a side scene that they talk that comes up.
Okay.
So his brother gets fingered.
Yeah. Tom Green do we really want to talk about this? Tom Green
no.
Heat off of himself, says that his brother was molested by Rip Torn, his dad. And it's fake.
Torn?
Tom Green wants Rip Torn. You know the actor, Rip Torn?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Tom Green's father. Tom Green says that his little brother got fingered by him to get the heat off of himself. And then because Freddie is 25 or something, and Child Protective Services comes and gets him and puts him in a mental hospital. It's maybe 3 minutes of the movie, like pretty late in, and has no relevance to the rest of the film.
Jesus.
Yeah.
It's awful.
It's horrible.
We'll get drunk and watch it sometime. Next time you come to New York, Gus.
No.
We will.
All right. So they're having a good time in Audie's the Coolest and chapter 21.
Yeah. Chapter 21.
I need to pee.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be right back.
You're going to bring the mic with you or? Okay. You're going to leave it? Okay. Got it. I might as well give him another drink. I'm going to go do that. I'm excited. We're on to another great titled chapter. Probably the best of the bad title chapters, Means of Escape. I feel like compared to How Dogs Are Trained and A Road Between Two Dentists, we're on a high. Abercrombie's figuring out how to title the Glockton chapters. It's better. It's not great, but it's better. It's slightly less obvious and more interesting as we go. He's not quite there yet. He's figuring out Glockta as he goes. He realized he has a real zinger of a character, and he's just got to give him the edgelordiest titles he can get to.
It's a pretty good chapter. So John Harm is banging on the door of the Mercer Guild.
Big dick swinging John Harm in there.
I mean, he's a bit of a giant.
In the name of the king, open your goddamn door. Locke is like, perhaps they've heard you opening the door.
Yeah, and they just don't want to.
You stupid fucking idiot.
Break it open, you slut.
Oh, boy. So that slut does not break it open. That slut just stops. And
this other slut, the big albino slut, he charges. Oh, God.
No. We got to start it over. There's no way.
Why?
There's no way we can use slut.
Really?
Wait. This is a sex positive podcast, Gus. He's using it in a positive way.
Fucking Ian called somebody a dago like a few chapters ago. We can't say slut.
I love it. Okay. This. So we have a
sex, guys. I am allowed to say the word.
The Means of Escape. Chapter 21.
Are we really? Oh my god.
I don't know, guys.
I
let's try it one more time.
No, we cannot.
I will kill myself if I have to do my whole three chapters title.
All right. So that slut breaks down the door.
Hey, welcome to the first Lodcast. This is Ian Bertram.
How do we do this? John Horm's a fucking idiot, and he sucks. And all we know about him so far is that he's horny and gossipy and stupid, and that's why Glockta's perhaps they've heard you, but they've decided not to open it. So open the door, you ingrate.
Or break it down, yeah. And then Frost comes in with a real big assist. He just smashes it down.
I mean, it's funny that Jalen Horm is like, open a door without permission, insanity.
right.
Breaks the door down, and Jalen Horm's like, I've never seen such a thing. oh, it's funny.
Yeah, and then we get like a scene which is essentially Glockta walking up the stairs while Frost in front of him just beats the living shit out of everyone in the building.
Cool. I feel like it's slow-mo a little bit.
He's totally.
Pointing at people and being like, arrest, arrest. And arrest just means like bludgeon.
Yeah. And knock them down and bludgeon them after
death.
I mean, in one person, he's even like, I did nothing wrong. And they start bludgeoning him and he just goes, I confess.
I confess.
It's
an
amazing encapsulation of exactly what it is. I got to say, though, it's funny to call this scene cool. I saw it as that scene from Airplane where everybody's going crazy. It's just like there's fires, people hanging from the chandeliers, throwing everything everywhere. Yeah. It's pandemonium when they go inside this guild.
Or
the
end of Wishmaster.
I've never seen that movie. So yeah,
nobody has.
Okay.
Wes Craven's Wishmaster.
I've only seen it because you've forced me to watch that guy years and years ago.
It's going to be Freddy Got Fingered soon, though.
The Wishmaster.
Wishmaster? Wishmaster. A huge slew of practicals. They surge into the place, and we learn that there are more practical. I mean, we haven't seen much of the enforcement arm of the Inquisition, and there's a bunch of practicals. There's a ton.
Yeah, I was surprised. I assumed there were just a handful. I mean, it's funny because it's like Jalenhorm's there with the king's men to make this happen. And I feel like Jalenhorm is just standing there agape as these, I imagine, hooded practicals run in and just start beating the shit out of everybody.
They all have sticks because they don't want to kill anybody. They all have basically like truncheons.
Yeah.
And they're just bludgeoning all of these mercers and...
And like assistants, just people there. It's crazy.
Right.
I can't believe that one guy says, I confess. I did nothing wrong and I confess immediately. It was perfect.
That's what you do.
And then Glockta gets to the top of the stairs.
Well, he gets dragged down a few times by like different merchants being like, no, oh, don't hurt me. And he's like scrabbling at the wall, Looney Tunes style. And then somebody protects him. The latest version of that is Jalenhorm. He's like, well, I guess he's good for something, which is picking me up.
Pick me up and helping me up the stairs.
Yeah.
And he's even, and he clocked his thinking like, damn my leg. I should have been here earlier because the mercers are clearly destroying evidence. I mean, that's why there's all this pandemonium. They know this is coming. Somebody tipped them off at some point, and they are burning everything.
It's all over the town. I mean, Audie knew it. Everyone knows it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Glockta gets to a room that is marked with Colt's name.
It's the boss battle.
Yeah, boss battle. Pushes it open and sees Colt, and he's like, oh, you're still here. How fascinating. And then we see that Colt has a rope tied around his neck.
Right.
And the rope leads out the window. And he's like,
And is attached to his, like, his big fucking Mercer desk. Like, just a concrete.
Oh, yes. No, that's what it is. Yeah. Wood. The rope is attached to the desk. Yeah. And Glockta's like, is your collar too tight, Magister Colt? And basically starts buying. Glockta starts buying time.
Because Frost does another Looney Tunes thing.
I
like,
love that bit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He like
you
peeking
see
around
white
the door.
Fingers, like, yeah.
He's totally pulling an Elmer Fudd, like sneaking, putting his back up against the thing, looking around the corner. Colt's got shit to say. Like Colt wants to talk. Glockta doesn't need to really get him going because Colt's basically being like, "You idiot! I'm nothing. I am a dumb patsy of a bunch of other people. I have nothing." Which is crazy because you're looking around this room. It's everything is golden and gilded and beautiful, at least from a distance. It's right.
This is the first like full noir Glockta thread where he's like you know nothing about the world. Whatever you think is incorrect.
Yeah, it's Chinatown.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's totally neo noir. He gives him like. I assume for the rest of this novel, like his map for who he has to go investigate.
Right. The bankers and everyone. I mean, it's a pretty amazing moment when like Glockta is like, oh, I know there's somebody in the House of Questions. It's Kaline. And Colt is like, Kaline? Kaline's too fucking honorable. Like, no, it's the
dummy.
You idiot. It's the secretary of Salt. And Glockta is like, oh, my God. They saw every letter that went between everyone. Of course the fucking Mercers are burning everything. Of course the Mercers were trying to kill everyone. It's like their mole wasn't Kaline. It was the fucking assistant. It's right. just, it makes so much more sense than K-Line 2, even when you see it. And like, who's the actual problem? The Mercers? No, it's the banks that the Mercers owe all their money to, who are forcing them to do all these things. I mean, the Mercers are still fucking stealing money and shit, obviously, but it's small time compared to what's happening on the closed right. council. And so like, and the fact that they're saying it's on the closed council, it's in the House of Questions, it's probably also, what's his name? Morovia too. Like, it's probably all of them.
Cult names explicitly the closed council, the Inquisition, the university, and the banks.
Which mm-hmm. And we get the name of the bank for the first time, which right. is Valentin Bulk.
Yeah.
I should also say it's specific members of the closed council, too. It's not the closed council, full stop, but Salt specifically
he says the closed council, full stop.
Well, he says, look in the closed council, look in the universities, look in the banks.
Right. I took it to mean like Salt clearly is implicated in some point. And we know Salt at the very least wants more control of the closed council, but
sure.
Of Valentin Bulk in the university. We've seen nothing of the university yet either. And I love a college. I'm a college boy. So I love a college. I'm excited about this. That one guy in the library up north, he just had one book over and over again.
Yeah.
The university.
Oh, you want more books?
I want more books, guys.
So
call me educated.
So Frost is sneaking around the back way and
just a giant albino just tiptoeing. Just
he's a big sneak. He's a big sneak. And Glockta glances at him, which is a rookie mistake. Colt sees him glancing and is like, oh shit, there's a dude behind me, and jumps out of the window.
But Frost, being a motherfucking like fast dude, grabs him by the collar.
Yeah.
He pulls him back in, but guess what?
It's shitty clothing.
It's shitty clothing. And then Colt hits the glass, but guess what? It's shitty glass.
No, it's nice glass. That's the whole thing. It's clothing and nice glass.
Wait, is
so,
that what he said? If there was more lead in the glass, does that mean the glass is too nice? Okay, I took it the wrong way.
Because it's a very thin, precise glass. It's like a very rich person's glass.
So it's like the building, like the gilded shit everywhere. Because I guess I didn't put this together. So the building is beautiful. The building supplied potentially by the bankers.
But everything in it is cheap.
Everything in it is cheap. And not just that, but Magister Colt himself is wearing stuff that is finely dyed. It looks good, but it itself is cheap. So Colt isn't.
So if the glass would have been shittier and stronger, because like the more precise, the more elegant, the more delicate, the easier it is to break through. So he just shatters through it immediately.
The clothing had been of higher quality. Yeah. Then Frost's hand around the collar would have held him in.
Yeah.
But Colt goes out, and everybody outside who's heard of the commotion or seed the guards banging on the door, they witness Colt dying out there. This felt contrived, though. This felt contrived. Like, just step off the desk. Why do you have to jump out the window? Maybe
wait,
I don't
to hang yourself?
Yeah,
you can't step off a desk to hang yourself.
But he's going to jump through a window? Like, I don't know if Colt... Like, this whole thing felt like contrived.
Doing it.
A way for Colt to die. Felt really contrived to me.
It felt a little bit like he had been so powerless for so long in the hands of Valentin Bulk that this was his, like, getting a little something back.
That is a bit of what he said.
I don't mean it like that. I mean, literally, the mechanics of, like, I'm going to hang myself by jumping through a window, hoping the window will break. Like, obviously it did. It just felt contrived to me, like...
I mean, it would be funny if he jumped into it and it didn't break.
I mean, windows can be harder than you think they'd be, right?
No, modern windows...
I've been excited about the ice cream van and ran into a window and didn't break at all. So I'm just saying, like, it felt weird to me. We don't need to go into the details of that, the mechanics of that.
All right. So he jumps out, he hangs himself, and that's kind of the end of the chapter.
Yes.
Yeah. Glockta said to Jallenhorm, go and disperse this filthy
the
crowd.
Infinitely gormless Jallenhorm to disperse the crowd so they can cut him down and figure out what's going on.
I can't wait to see more Jallenhorm, guys.
I mean, he's kind of our hero.
He's fun now. You know, he's horny. He's gossipy. He's ineffectual. I'm here for it.
He's a big old brute of a man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody's big, though, right? Have we heard of a small character yet? Everyone's just huge.
Gus, you said it. Yeah, you said it, like, in the north. Well, there's only like a giant and then giant plus and giant triple or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, extra giant. Who's actually huge. Yeah. So what they did, it is funny. It's like, ah, he's short. Galacta is he described as short or is it just?
Well, I think he's only short because they took like pieces out of his legs and like they broke and
maybe
him.
Spine or like shit. Like he's just a hunched.
I got a feeling that this is going to be some J.K. Rowling shit where like J.K. Rowling hates fat people. Like it's very clear if you read Harry Potter that J.K. Rowling hates fat people. I'm excited.
Well, didn't she come out this week with like another anti-trans comment?
Well, that was the anti-trans thing. But this is regardless of that. Like no one.
Wait, what did she say?
I didn't read it.
It was just some basic fucking like turf shit. Like we can't like not pay attention to women's issues by looking at these. Like trans people deserve their rights, but they should be trans people. They're not women. They're trans people. It was shit like that. But
cool. Oh yeah. Good job, Drew. Good job.
Like, oh yeah, like Molly donated a bunch of money to charity by going like, I will draw you new tattoos to go over your Harry Potter tattoos and shit.
Really?
Like that.
That's fucking awesome. Really?
Cool.
Yeah, Molly did that this week. Because of this. But J.K. Rowling's been fat phobic for a long time. And you know,
I don't really know if I've heard this take, but
if you read the books, it's very clear. Every fat character is evil or stupid.
Yeah, you're totally right. Fuck, I didn't think of that.
Their only character who's maybe is Professor Sprout, who is motherly and happy. Slughorn is fat and is a Slytherin apologist. The Dursleys are fat and they are child abusers. Peter Pettigrew.
The Dursleys are not. Absolutely, the Dursleys are good people.
What?
Oh, the Dursleys. No, but there's only two fat people. They're all portly.
Weasleys.
The mother is portly. There are two fat women.
Oh, kind of portly.
No, there are two fat women. It's Professor Sprout and it's Molly Weasley. And they are both like motherly.
Fucker? Kind. Umbridge. Fucker?
Umbridge is fat and evil. Peter Pettigrew is fat and evil. The Dursleys are fat and evil. Slughorn is a fat and a Slytherin apologist. Like they're all it's very obvious she hates fat people. Anyway, this is getting off the point. I'm just waiting to realize that Joe Abercrombie hates short people for the first short person to come up and be like, the evil leprechaun or some shit. I'm excited for that.
I'm not excited for that. I really hope that doesn't happen. I love Abercrombie. He's he's my favorite author.
I realize I'm full of shit even as I'm saying this because one of the most scary evil people is Fenris, who's the tallest person. So maybe I'm full of shit, but leaving all this stuff about J.K. Rowling being a fat phobe because no one's this is a new ammo against J.K. Rowling and we should be talking about it.
See. All right. So we got to the end of that chapter. That was fun.
I had a great time, guys. This is good. It's hanging out with the chums, hanging out with my boys. I love it.
Peter, you are a good man.
Thank you.
Okay. So next week,
neither of you liked that comment. Okay.
I love it. No,
Peter liked it
and kindly saying thank you. I was being modest.
Yes.
So next week we're going to do 22.
We're doing at least four chapters. These chapters are short.
Okay, cool.
It's Gus. It's gonna be.
It's been a rough week. Been a rough week, guys.
It's gonna be a good episode. I'm just.
And I'll say that.
I'm sorry you have to edit so much. It's gonna be a good episode. I promise.
Okay.
I'll buy you a delivery beer and a shot. Either way, Gus. Great. Just let me know. I'll do it.
And remember, listeners, please be horrible to us. Mean, terrible, everything that you hate about yourselves, please tell us.
But seriously, anybody listening, thank you for listening. That's amazing.
Also thank you.
We're working through this book. I'm glad that you guys are reading this too with us. I presume you probably are.
Or you've read it many times before and you just love it, which is also fine. Stands are accepted.
And tell us if we fucked anything up.
We did, and so let us know.
Tell us the one thing that we fucked up. I'm sure there wasn't more than that.
With the fire,
your favorite thing,
to the right or the left? I think the right. Gus thinks the left. Ian thinks inexplicably there were two camps. So let us know.
I'm sticking with the two. I'm sticking with the two.
Yeah, games. Ian's like all about good people on both sides. So,
oh,
all right, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We love you.
Black Thanks, guys. Friends. Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Alrighty. So for next episode, we'll be covering four chapters, actually. So that is Chapter 22, Three Signs, Chapter 23, Theatrical Outfitters, Chapter 24, Barbarians at the Gate, and Chapter 25, Next. See y'all then.